morning, members. Let's see, we have a big day today. And just a reminder that we will be meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30. So make sure our committee is on your calendar. Let's see, today, all of the bills are going to be laid over, and I believe we have three amendments. So there will be three voice votes today. So members, with that, I'm going to call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll. Chair is present.
Schultz, present. Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright?
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Burkle, present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel? Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Noor?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, present.
Good to see you yesterday, Representative Novotny. Representative Pearson? Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen? Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher? He signed in earlier. I know he's here. We have a quorum, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. So we have a quorum. Let's see. Representative Albright, would you like to move the minutes from March 23rd?
I'll move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Albright moves the minutes from March 23rd, 2022. Or any corrections or comments on the minutes? Not seeing any. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill we have up today is House File 3271. We have Representative Katiza Watun with us today, and I think she may be on her phone. Welcome back. I'm going to make the motion to lay over House File 3271 for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. And I see you have an A1 amendment. Would you like us to adopt it? Maybe describe it a little bit, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the A1 amendment just to get the bill in the shape I'd like.
Okay. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 3271 is a proposal to increase access to lower cost outpatient mental health services. As has been the subject of much discussion over the past 2 years, demand for mental health services has skyrocketed as we continue to work to minimize the stigma surrounding mental health care and as the COVID-19 pandemic has stretched many of us to the edge of our emotional and psychosocial capacities. Unfortunately, we've also seen several providers eliminate these services entirely and work to shift patients to more intensive and higher cost therapies. In 2021, the legislature passed a study of the rates for outpatient behavioral health services. This report isn't due to the legislature until January 15th of 2024. The current rates are not sustainable, and this 10% increase provided in House File 3271 will provide some minimal assistance until a larger rework of the rate setting system can be completed. Increased rates will allow providers to better recruit a talent pool in this competitive market by offering more competitive wages in these critical roles. So House File 3271 does have the support of NAMI, the department, and various provider groups. With that, Madam Chair, I know we have at least one testifier on the line today, and I would ask that they share their thoughts.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watun. We have Mark Arnold. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you so much. I'm Mark Arnold. I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Nystrom & Associates. We are one of, if not the largest provider of outpatient mental health services in the state of Minnesota. And specific to this bill, which addresses two specific programs, the ARMS, Adult Mental Health the Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services, and CTSS, the Children's Therapeutic Services and Support. Through our affiliated entity, Family Support Services, I believe we are the largest provider of those services in the state of Minnesota as well. Thank you for hearing us today. As the representative mentioned, this is a real critical issue for us right now. While we wait for the study that's due in 2024 to occur and to be reported on, we are dealing with a real challenge across all mental health services, but in particular, these are community-based services that have not seen a rate increase in 5 years. And with wage inflation over that same five-year period, over 15%, and will likely go up another 4 or 5% this year, we and other providers are struggling to hire qualified mental health practitioners to provide these services. As a result, we are seeing a huge drop in our ability to meet the massive demand for these services today. To put a little bit of reference around that, the number of hours we billed for these services in Minnesota last year for our ARMS program, we were down over 40%, and in the CTSS program, down over 60%. That wasn't due to any initiative on our part to reduce services, nor was it due to lack of demand. It was due strictly to our ability to hire and retain mental health practitioners to provide those services. So this is a real critical issue. We're asking for help to get us to 2024 when that rate study will be completed. The intent of these programs is to keep people out of more intensive services. On the ARMS side, it's to ensure medication education. To you're dealing with many patients with SPMI, severe persistent mental illness, who are on who are being provided other services, including psychiatry, medication management, other issues to deal with their mental health diagnosis. These programs are meant to help keep these people out of inpatient services, to reduce the demand on other Medicaid services. And then on the CTSS side, it's really around development for children with a diagnosed medical mental health disorder. And once again, reducing both short-term and long-term costs of utilization of other services. So this is a real critical issue for us. We are really struggling right now for multiple reasons to hire. As I think we all know how difficult hiring is in general, it's particularly challenging for us right now in these programs. A couple of other notes related to the hiring piece. Part of what's creating this challenge is this dramatic increase in demand for all mental health services. So while our community-based ARMS and CTSS services are down because we can't hire enough people, our outpatient mental health services done in our clinics are up at a similar rate to the decline that we've seen in the community-based services. And what's happening is there's so much demand for the outpatient services that providers are hiring unlicensed providers right out of school with no training to be outpatient therapists at compensation levels that are 50% higher than what we're able to pay our community-based providers today based on reimbursement. So that's one piece. The other challenge is these are normally mental health practitioners who are unlicensed. They're at the beginning of their career, so they're on the lower pay scale. We're now competing with retail, restaurants, and others where we've seen massive wage inflation here in the last year. And so we're getting pulled on both sides, pulled from other mental health providers and pulled from kind of non-traditional competition for employees on the bottom end. So this is a real challenge for us. We want to, at Nystrom, continue to provide these services, but we just can't do it at a loss. We can't raise rates or can't raise compensation given where the current reimbursement rates are without losing money. And we are seeing, we're aware of at least two other ARMS and CTSS providers that have recently stopped providing services. And we have heard rumors of multiple others that are considering it as well for the same reason.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold, for your testimony. Are there any questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Katizawatun, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Just have a couple questions for either the author of the bill, Madam Chair, or for Mr. Arnold. The first is we talk about an increase of 10% in these rates, and I'm just wondering if Mr. Arnold could expand in terms of what utilization would these increases be used for by the providers?
Thank you, Representative Albright. Mr. Arnold.
I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
I think he's asking if the rates did increase, where would the increased reimbursement go to? Would it go to wages or other things?
It would go to additional hiring. So yes, I mean, for us to hire more people, we need to be competitive on the wage front. So while we're not, the intent isn't to go in and increase wages for every one of our existing employees. The intent is for us to be able to be competitive in offering employees competitive wages in order to hire them.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the author of the bill. Obviously, with an increase of 10% based upon an existing balance, I'm just wondering if Representative Katizawatun has any semblance of idea in terms of what that fiscal note might be in the range, or the expectation is we'll have to see it once it gets into the omnibus bill.
I'm going to guess it's the latter, but Representative Katizawatun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not have kind of that estimated amount, but I think what I would say is that I think it's always a good investment to help Minnesotans invest in their mental health. And while we have a budget surplus, this is a really good time to be having that conversation. So I appreciate the committee's consideration for this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Albright, any final question?
Madam Chair, we're going to have a busy time putting that bill together with the fiscal notes, aren't we?
We are. We'll talk later. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions. So, Representative Katizawatun, any closing comments, although you probably just gave some. Anything else?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the consideration and all the important work that that you are all doing on this committee, and thanks to Chair Fisher, too, for his leadership in the behavioral health arena, too. I appreciate it, and that's all.
Okay, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Mr. Arnold, for your testimony. With that, House File 3271, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Okay, next bill we have is House File 3371. I'm going to move to adopt the division report from Behavioral Health for House File 3371 members. This is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And I see Chair Moran, welcome back. I see that you have an A5 amendment. Would you like to quickly describe it before we adopt it?
Yes, but Madam Chair, before I do that, the bill before us is 3372.
Oh, sorry. Let me just check on that. I might need to get my glasses out, Representative Moran. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, though. Okay, Representative, or House File 3372, sorry. We have to redo the voice vote, sorry, members. I will move to adopt the division report for House File 3372 from the Behavioral Health Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. To your A5 amendment, Representative Moran.
Yes, Madam Chair. And before I describe the amendment, there was a miss on another line that needed to be deleted in the amendment that was not included. So I'm hoping I can do an oral amendment to delete that line, to delete a few words.
Would you describe that, or did you want someone else? Did you want reason?
Yeah, no, I can describe it.
Okay,
so
go ahead.
On line 1.11, the words primary care screenings should be deleted.
You know what I'm going to suggest, Representative Moran, is that mm-hmm. this bill's going to be laid over. We can fix that language when it's laid over.
Okay,
so
perfect.
I don't think we need to, I just don't want to, our House staff is really busy, and I just don't want to do an oral amendment and maybe do it incorrectly. So
okay.
If that's okay with you, Chair Moran, we can fix that before it gets into the amendment.
All right,
bill.
Perfect. So the A5 amendment clarifies that it has to be an African-American mental health center, and it adds supervision and training to the list of services.
Okay.
All right. So
let's move to adopt the A5 amendment. So I'm going to my motion is to move the A5 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted to House File 3372. Okay. Chair Moran, to your bill as amended.
Yes. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing this bill to come before the body. Even before the pandemic, Madam Chair, outcomes and disparities for Black children and families has been terrible for African Americans here in Minnesota. The last 2 years has been extremely hard for African Americans with the pandemic, COVID-19, the murder of George Floyd, the civic unrest, the insurrection has made many African Americans looking for therapy for themselves, their children, and family members. Minnesota struggles to catch up as minority mental health needs grow. Historically, many in the African American community has been hesitant to seek mental health care because of stigma, discrimination from some providers, and a lack of cultural competent care. But as more people are seeking mental health care to help them cope with the grief and trauma, they're looking for therapists they can trust. The African American Child Wellness Institute adopts a certified community behavior health center as their strategy and the most effective process for providing mental health and substance use disorder services for African American children and their families through an evidence-based lens. Madam Chair and member, today you will hear from testifiers why House File 3372 is needed. And I have several testifiers today, and I believe we're going to start with Dr. Bravada.
Thank you, Chair Moran. So we have with us today Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name correctly if I've misstated it, and then your affiliation, but really glad to have you with us today. Go ahead. Okay, we're having trouble. You need to unmute. There you go.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. The name is Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. I'll say it in just a moment. I just want to say good morning, Chair Schultz, Representative Moran, and other distinguished committee members. My name is Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. I am the Executive Director of the African American Child Wellness Institute. And I am here to speak in support of HF 3372. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist with over 40 years of experience in the field of mental health. I've served clients whose ages range from birth to death. I am a fellow of the American Psychological Association and a board certified diplomat and fellow in African-centered Black psychology. And I am a past president of both the Minnesota Psychological Association, as well as the Minnesota Association of Black Psychologists. I have written, presented, and consulted extensively in the areas of developmental psychology, women's issues, trauma, community violence, multiculturalism, poverty, homelessness, severe psychopathology, and African-American mental health. The African American Child Wellness Institute, ACWI, is a 501c3 nonprofit Rural 29 Community Mental Health Center and is located in North Minneapolis as well as in Plymouth. We provide mental health services across the state, reaching clients in places such as Rochester, Mankato, St. Cloud, Duluth, and the metro area. ACWI's mission is to provide the psychological and spiritual liberation of children of African descent and their families by providing culturally specific mental health services and developing access to culture-based, holistic wellness resources, research, and practices. Through DHS's CIMIC program, Cultural Ethnic Minority Infrastructure Grant, ACWI has been able to provide clinical ancillary services to connect uninsured and underinsured children and their families to cultural-specific mental health providers and services. We provide capacity building for licensure services for African-American children to gain training through clinical supervision and culturally congruent, trauma-informed, practice-based, evidence-based strategies. Through our program, we have trained more than 40 African-American licensed clinicians. Due to inadequate funding from the CIMIC program, we have not been able to offer competitive salaries. Thus, we have lost all of our licensed clinicians to other entities, except one, who just came back. We provide because of a grant, we provide community-based services through outreach to provide psychoeducation about behavioral health to children and their families via public education programs and activities. The problems are, it is no secret that African-American children and families of Minnesota experience a severe disparities in multiple systems, including education, foster care, criminal justice, and mental health. Sadly, a recent Minnesota student survey revealed that while 15% of Black ninth grade youth reported having long-term mental health and behavioral or emotional health problems, that had lasted more than 6 months or more, only 9% of them had ever been treated during the last year. These systemic practices have a deleterious impact on the lives of African-American youth and have a glaring impact on issues of safety, trauma, suicide, drug abuse, and exposure to violence. Our psychological research shows us that health outcomes for Black patients are better when they are treated by Black providers. That research is critical given that African Americans in the United States experience poorer health outcomes across a variety of diseases and conditions. And if we are invested in Black youth and their families from a perspective of not seeing them being at risk, to see them being in a space of being at promise, the trajectory of their lives can be positively changed. Your support of HF 3372 will do this. It will expand access to culturally specific and comprehensive mental health services for adults and children. It will increase the number of licensed mental health providers of African descent in the workforce who can then render culturally specific and proficient care to children and adults of African descent. It will support at-risk and at-promise parents and youth, whether they face circumstances including poverty, mental illnesses, substance abuse, or physical health challenges. And importantly, it will support the development of innovative, collaborative models for service delivery among people of African descent. And with that, I close, and I am available for further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Bravada Garrett-Ikensanya. An honor to have you here, and you're very persuasive. You should testify more often. But Ray, thank you for, and thank you for all the work you do with our youth. Really appreciate it. The next testifier I have is it Tamiko Ralston? Welcome to the committee. Yeah. Please state your name and pronounce it correctly for me if I've mispronounced it, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I want to thank you for allowing us to speak on House Child.
332, and also thank Arthur Representative Moran for introducing this bill. I'm Tamiko Ralston, a public health nurse in Ramsey County. I have been working alongside Ramsey County residents with small children and community stakeholders for over 20 years. I am a founding member of the Birth Equity Community Council. I am on the advisory boards of the Programs in Health Disparities Research within the University of Minnesota's Medical School. I'm on ICHRP, the Integrative Care for High-Risk Pregnancies Advisory Board, and also an executive committee member of the Minnesota Department of Health Maternal Child Health Advisory Task Force. I was trained as a LPCC, or Licensed Professional Clinical Counselor, through the African American Child Wellness Institute, and am now the owner of Protector Factors Integrated, a mental health clinic specializing in working alongside African American families. I am here to discuss the critical need for mental health providers to serve the African American community, utilizing a culturally specific focus, such as what's provided at the African American Child Wellness Institute. The integration of practice-based evidence and evidence-based assessments and treatments were very much a part of my experiences at the African American Child Wellness Institute. I was prepared through evidence-based reflective practice, case consultations, and direct experiential learning opportunities, as evidenced by my ability to pass the state licensure exam at first attempt, and most importantly, seeing positive outcomes with individuals and families utilizing the African-centered wellness model. Dr. Bravada fostered an environment for career development and healing through allowing staff at no cost to participate in routine internal and external group trainings, bringing in experts from the field while also receiving case consultation, supervision, and weekly trainings. While in my master's studies, I discovered just how hands-on preparation I had received in comparison to students assigned to other sites who had not had the experiential learning opportunities that are imperative for being ready not only to sit for licensure, but also practice. I take with me those experiences into my work as a nursing supervisor and also a therapist. Your support of this bill will help remove barriers to clients accessing services, which I see in my community engagement with residents and in consultation with public health colleagues. And for students who may otherwise be unable to pay for supervision required for licensure. It also creates pathways for providers by speeding the process for insurance paneling or credentialing, which is another challenge that mental health therapists face in applying to receive reimbursement for services, often leading to therapists providing cash-only pay options, which many community members cannot afford, increasing disparities in health outcomes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Ralston, for being with us today, and thank you for identifying those barriers and challenges. And also, thank you for all the great work you're doing on health equity. Really appreciate it. Okay, the third testifier we have is, I believe, is it Ms. Kennedy?
No, it's Al McFarland.
No, sorry, Al McFarland, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representative Moran, and members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 3372. My name is Al McFarlane, and I'm a member, a Minnesota business owner residing in North Minneapolis. My company, McFarlane Media Interests, Inc., owns and publishes the leading Black community newspaper in the state, Insight News. I serve as editor of the publication, and I lead the Minnesota Multicultural Media Consortium, whose members mobilized to carry out critical information and education missions to encourage adoption of protocols, testing, and vaccine adoption to combat the COVID-19 pandemic in Minnesota. I am a board member, in fact, the vice chair of the board for Greater Twin Cities United Way, and I'm proud to serve as board chair of African American Child Wellness Institute. The COVID-19 pandemic has taught us the importance of reaching, serving, engaging Black residents in places and ways that allow our people to see ourselves not just as the problem, but rather as the solution. In that light, as a communications and marketing professional, I support African American Child Wellness Institute's work to change the narrative about mental health and wellness. The Institute is demonstrating the value of broadening awareness and access by developing culturally competent mental health and wellness services. The Institute's work and methodology deliver healing to children, to individuals and families, while uniquely in its public-facing outreach, nurtures a vocabulary that enables the creation of a public mind in the Black community that allows us to articulate our personal and collective needs without shame or stigma, thus taking ownership of our health and well-being. Madam Chair, Representative Moran, members, thank you for the opportunity to share this information. I am available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland, for being with us today. Now, I've limited testimony to three testifiers for all the bills, but we do have with us Chris Bray. She has a PhD, lead researcher at the Wilder Research Center. And we have Mr. Akinsanya. With us for questions. If anyone, I would like to go to questions, and if we have more time, Chair Moran, then we can maybe take another testifier. But let's see how the time management goes. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Moran, thank you for bringing this bill forward. There's some very intriguing testimony, to be sure. One of the things that I do note, and this is for Dr. Garrett Akinsanya, she received and her organization received a grant during COVID for crisis counseling and training. And I'm just wondering if the doctor could elaborate in terms of the outcomes that she saw from that grant.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Dr. Bravada.
Thank you so much for asking that question. And I will be more than happy to talk about the successful opportunities we had with the grant that we were given to reach specifically the African-American community regarding COVID. I'd like to first say that, just to interrupt myself, I want to say that we do have a parent here. Her name is Kiana. She was the one who's going to talk about how important the service has been to her. And we left her for the last because we wanted her to explain that all of this that we talk about ends up in the lap of a parent and in a child that she fought so hard to save. So I really hope that someone will give her a chance and make an exception for her to speak. I don't know if I'm out of line by asking that, but that's what I'm asking. I'm going to go ahead and answer the question about the grant we had to address COVID. We had a two-prong approach, actually three-prong. Our grant allowed us to do community-based outreach and through partnerships with multiple agencies, people like Mad Dads and Mother's Love and the Black Nurses and our team. We went out to homeless shelters. We went to the tents. We went to churches and schools and Cub and barbershops and beauty shops to get the word out about how to prevent COVID and how to save our lives. We had a second prong beside the outreach. That second prong was us doing live shows. We had a program on the radio, Healing Circle, where we talked about that and talked about the grief and loss, because our community, as you all probably know, is disproportionately affected by COVID. And every single day, we were acknowledging people who are dying. So we had that Healing Circle. We had a strong community telehealth outreach program for people who needed counseling. And then the other part we also had was in that communications part is that we did outreach, like I said, with other places like schools that had school buses and things like that they were doing. And finally, at the end of the program, we had a site visit from, so I hit the prong of outreach, the mm-hmm. counseling, and also the communication media part component where we had PSAs. And in the end of the, at the end of the grant period, funded us for additional money because we had done such an outstanding job. FEMA and as well as SAMHSA came forward and did a site visit in Minnesota. And the DHS created a report. And in the report, it showed that there are 11 organizations in our state who has the opportunity to get COVID grants. And our little organization, we produce 45.34% of the work and the outcome. Mm-hmm. We reached 45% of all of the people met and reached through the organizations. So we way outperformed what they expected of us. And someone from SAMHSA asked, how did you do this? And my answer was because we are part of our community. We know our community. And part of that is that we shouted, we beat the drums, and everyone in the community came running to help. So that's how we did it. And I certainly thank Representative Albright for asking that question so that I can share that good news of what happens when little Davids get a chance to deal with big Goliaths with help.
Thank you, Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. Akinsanya, sorry.
Perfect. Now you're speaking Yoruba.
Representative Albright. Final question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. And this is actually for the author of the bill, Representative Moran. We often deal with these grant programs, and while I know that the work that has just been described by Dr. Garrett Akinsanya is beneficial to the community, just wondering why we are sole sourcing this appropriation as opposed to making it into a competitive grant program for others. And that is in no way implying or denigrating the good work of the Institute. But then also, Chair Moran, will there be any reporting requirements or any type of metrics in terms of how we can measure success for this funding as we move forward?
Chair Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. One of the main reasons that I put before the body to get direct appropriation to the African American Child Wellness Institute is because of their trust, is because of the expertise that they bring to the table. One of the things Dr. Bravada did not say is why they did such a great job is because it's trust. Trust. We have some of the worst disparities in African American community, and being able to go to a trusted entity that we can see a reflection in ourselves and the outcome, where there's connection and understanding, where we can begin to heal, to elevate us being successful in life, comes from a trusted entity. We have talked so much about that there is a lack of a workforce here. There's even a greater lack of Black professionals. We in the state of Minnesota have done a really terrible job of investing into our organizations. we have done a terrible job of seeing the value that we bring to this state to lift up our African-American children and families in our community. And I just want to share, I was going to save it for later. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. But I give you an example as a mother of four Black sons. I hit one of my sons who was really challenging me, through high school. It wasn't nice for him or for me. And that behavior lasted until he was like 20. And then I woke up one morning after hearing about this organization that was a Black-led male organization that I got up one morning and said to him, we're going down to this organization. I took him down there, and the first person he saw when he walked into that door was actually was a Black woman. But the whole facility was being headed by African-American men. And within 2 weeks of him being engaged in that organization, I saw a change in his behavior. I saw a change in the expectations that were needed for him to be successful. I saw that connection that was there. That is still there. He's still a part of it. He can go in and talk to those peer counselors. He can go in and talk to those social workers. And so even though there's a shortage in workforce, I believe in the importance of having those connections that allow the African-American who has historically been shamed, that has been historically not brought their mental health issues to the forefront, and that this is about creating an institution where we are adding to the workforce, that we've been intentional about who's doing that culturally specific training. It matters. Representative Albright and members, I am a true believer that race matters. It matters.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Representative you. Sandell. You're muted.
Thank you, Madam Fires. I had a chance earlier, last year during interim, to talk with individuals at the North Point Behavior Health and Health Clinics on the north side of Minneapolis. And I wonder what relationship your institute has with North Point. I know they do a terrific job. Could you explain and describe that relationship you might have?
Dr. Bravada, you're muted.
I am delighted to describe my relationship with North Point. In fact, I think I mentioned earlier that my office is in North Minneapolis. My office is directly across the street, embedded in the, it used to be Minneapolis Urban League, now it's Twin Cities Urban League. So my office is in the Minneapolis Urban League, Twin Cities Urban League. And I have an excellent relationship with Dr. Golden, who is over the behavioral health component, and Stella Whitney, who used to be at Urban League, who went across the street and started working at North Point. And they provide for us, before we had our own psychiatrists, they would provide for us fast-track access to the psychiatrists. They provide for us support in physical health. But what they, and they also, part of their staff, I'd say almost half of them, are the students that I trained. So 8 of the 40 people that I told you that I trained earlier, they work at North Point, and they would come back and work for me, except I can't pay those competitive salaries. So you've just helped me identify why we need additional funding, because these are culturally specific providers who went through training in my at my entity and who are actually leaders in that center. So they specifically, as you know, address different cultures. They are not a culturally specific agency, but they do have a lot of multicultural support for people, and they are also short on having people. They send me referrals constantly. And so, yeah, I love them. They love me. We help each other the best we can, but they know that the niche that we're providing, they cannot fill.
Thank you, Dr. Garrett Akinsanya. We do have 2 minutes, so do you want me to go to your last testifier, Ms. Kennedy?
Yes, I would love that.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kennedy. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. And I'm sorry, but I do have to limit it to 2 minutes. Really apologize for that.
That's okay. Good morning. My name is Kiana Kennedy, and I'm honored to be here to speak on behalf of the bill to fund a culturally specific agency such as African American Child Wellness Institute. I come today to talk about the importance of culturally specific mental health for African American children and their parents like me. My experience of coming to counseling in a place that specialized in my culture was life-changing. I felt safe because the atmosphere and the staff validated who we were, and that created comforting and welcoming environment. Sometimes I would be in tears because my child would get into trouble at school and I did not know what to do. My concerns were about what happens to Black boys who don't get the skills they need to ask for help to manage their emotions in school and other public places. They are at risk for joining gangs and going to prison or end up dead. They don't know how to cope. They don't know where to go. And I feel like the problem my son had would have escalated had I not seek help early on. My son learned the skills he needed to handle difficult situations. I feel like it taught him how to express himself, and it also gave him the skills to reach out for help as a normal thing to do. I don't think that the average guy knows how to ask for help. As a parent, I also participated in a free Project Marua parenting class. After going through Project Marua, we gained a lot of skills and learned techniques about how to discipline and communicate with our children as African-American parents. We also learn how to use each other as resources, and having the input of other mothers and fathers built a sense of community, and that was great. Now my son who had trouble being in class has demonstrated that he is more than okay, and that means everything to me because I know that when it's time to put him into the world, he has the skills to cope, and that makes me feel happy that I have provided him with that. In closing, I fully support funding culturally specific agencies like the African American Child Wellness because I can trust people like Dr. B and her staff to care about me, my child, and my community. And for that, I am grateful.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Excellent use of time. I really appreciate having all the testifiers here and appreciate Chair Moran's advocacy. Chair Moran, closing comments.
Madam Chair, the African American Child Wellness Institute does all of these things and have an impressive track record. In addition to providing mental health services, the AACWI trains dozens of providers who are people of color. They can be white, diverse, it doesn't matter. This is what they do. And they help them get licensed and certified. The Institute has been operating since 2008, providing children and families from a broad range of mental health services, regardless of their ability to pay. Madam Chair and members, I ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Moran. With that, members, I'm going to House File 3372, as amended, is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you all again. Okay, members, let's see. The next bill on our agenda is House File 4105. Welcome to the committee, Representative Thompson. Is this your first time in Human Services?
Yes, this is my first
time. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. So the best committee of all the committees. So my motion is to lay over. I have to adopt the division report. I'm going to move to adopt the division report from the Behavioral Health Division for House File 4105. Members, this is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And my motion will be to lay over House File 4105 for Human Services Omnibus, as for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. This is what happens when I don't have coffee in the morning. Okay, Representative Thompson, I don't see amendments to your bill.
There's an amendment.
Oh, there is an amendment.
Yes.
All right.
There is an amendment to the bill. You see it? You don't see it?
I'm going to ask Yingya Vang if there is an amendment that was submitted. Ms. Vang?
I don't believe I saw an amendment submitted for this one.
We can fix it later, Representative Thompson, because it's going to be laid over. So just describe your bill with us. Thanks.
Okay. So this bill is in response to the overwhelming need for behavioral health services in the most underserved communities in our state. And these communities are underserved, yet they deal in many cases with the greatest burden of stress, trauma, and what we call social detriments of health. They suffer from great racial disparities in health, education, income, employment, and the criminal justice context. And these burdens weigh on their health and their behavioral health. These communities are made up of Minnesotans who are African American, Native American, African immigrants, Latinos, Asians, and Pacific Islanders. And at the same time, we have great providers within our communities who are dedicated to responding to the behavioral health needs of these communities with assessment, counseling, treatment of diagnosable disorders from anxiety and depression to substance disorder. And they serve mental illnesses also. These providers themselves have become stressed and overburdened. They don't have the resources they need to respond effectively to all of those in their communities who are in their care. And this bill, I'm for sure, addresses this gap between the need in the underserved communities and the response from our great behavioral health providers by offering grants to those behavioral health providers who have demonstrated that they have strong relationship within and cultural ties to these communities that they serve. That cultural piece is key because it helps the providers gain the trust of those in the communities who may, you know, distrust other health providers because they just don't feel comfortable in the cultural setting that they're not familiar with. So, Madam Chair, this bill is a lifeline to these culturally competent behavioral health providers who are doing this difficult work because those who are not getting the care they need, they are our neighbors. In Minnesota, we all care about our neighbors here. And so, Madam Chair, I'm going to be quiet because I talk a lot. I want to pass over to my testifiers. I have three testifiers.
Okay. Here. I will go to – thank you, Representative Thompson. We'll go to Ms. Regina Jackson first. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Well, good morning. My name is Regina Jackson, and I am a licensed drug and alcohol counselor. I have been in kind of a semi-retirement piece.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thanks for having me. My name is Leah Soderlund.
You can proceed. That was just a glitch. Go ahead.
Oh. Since COVID, I have worked as a chemical health specialist probably since 1996, and connecting clients to appropriate mental health services has been an ongoing challenge. I am very honored and excited to have been a part of this meeting this morning because some of my most revered colleagues have been allowed to speak and talk about the work that they do. My connection in these days has what's been most important to me is working with young college students and students who have chosen to go into the fields of mental health and chemical health and trying to find ways to offer support because it's such a challenging field. And many times some of the students get through their internships and turn around. And so it's been very important to me to offer them enough support to keep going because as many of our testifiers have addressed the issue of finding and maintaining quality staff. And it's so important because it begins with training. I am here in Ramsey County, and the availability to culturally competent and culturally specific services is not as available as it is in Hennepin County. And I also understand and support this bill because we also need to meet these needs as I see, a lot of college towns where a lot of our African-American young people go to school, Mankato, St. Cloud, Duluth and some of those other areas. And I really would like to see more supportive, culturally competent services in those cities and near those college campuses. The young counselors that I have spoken to are, as Mr. Arnold from Nystrom's mentioned, are concerned with the rewards. You know, everybody's looking, they've got lots of college debt, and the salaries and the load of clients has been a deterrent for them to stay in the field. So I'd like to see more organizations maybe develop with a central focus so that they can provide competitive wages and maybe not have to spend as much money in administration. I'd love if they could build collaboratives with other programs, as those who were represented here in the meeting that are centered here in Minneapolis. If we had more funding to allow training in developing other clinics in some of the outer areas, as in Duluth and St. Cloud, because I do think proper training is critical for effective services to our minority or BIPOC communities. And I think there's been so much said already. I don't need to, you know, mention any statistical data, but definitely in the last two decades, it's evident that we need to increase services and accessibility to my African American community and other communities of color. And that's my piece.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We appreciate you being here today. And the next testifier I have is Mark Anderson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. Please state your name and any affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get on the reverse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Anderson. I'm Executive Director of Barbara Schneider Foundation. Let me just state that, I'm not a behavioral health provider. I'm not eligible for any of the funding in this program, but for the last 20 years, I've worked with partners in the justice system, in our behavioral health system, by training first responders on de-escalation of a behavioral health crisis so that responders can stay safe while keeping the person in crisis as well as community members safe. And so it's that experience that I'm bringing here to testify in support of Representative Thompson's bill. I've seen over these years an increased appreciation for the importance of behavioral health care in the justice system and in our healthcare system. I've also seen that more than half of those in our jails and prisons have a behavioral health problem. Tragically, we have not addressed the behavioral health care need as well as we hope to. This bill addresses this reality by supporting those behavioral health providers with the trust of the communities most burdened by our disparities in health care and in criminal justice contact. In my experience, African-American and Native American communities in particular bear enormous burden of trauma, historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, as well as anxiety, depression, substance use disorders, and other behavioral health challenges. This is a grant program for providers who have the trust of these communities. It builds on our strengths as a state. The barrier of distrust is a huge barrier to many who are reluctant to even seek help for those feelings and thoughts that are troubling them.
they're afraid or they're just reluctant to seek help for their behavioral health needs. We have in Minnesota great behavioral health agencies, programs, healers that have deep connections in these communities. They have the trust because people feel comfortable in these programs. They feel a cultural connection. We awkwardly sometimes call this cultural competence. What we mean is that a provider is deeply rooted in that particular culture so that they're literally part of that community. This bill is a grant program to support these providers that have that trusting relationship, but who lack the resources that they need to respond to all those who need assistance. It literally will help all our Minnesota communities heal. And I just would add that this morning, I think in the amendment that was mentioned, this grant program would be open until the end of June 30th on 2026. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And the final testifier I have is Fario Khalif. If you're with us, please state your name, affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fahia Khalif. I am with Voice of East African Woman, and I'm here today in support of House File 4105. As we all know, what happened in this state last couple of years, first Corona, that we saw what happened in around the world. And last 2 years, we saw what happened, the trauma and mental health crisis that the communities went through when George Floyd was killed. This is a bill that will help all Minnesotans, all around the state of Minnesota, including the Native community, the African American community, the African immigrants community, Asian community, Latinos, and Pacific Islanders, and all the human race that are struggling for mental health. Madam Chair and members, I heard everybody said everything that needs to be said. Please support. This is it's a bill that will help all these communities. It's a one-time funding that it looks like it will be good. It's a grant that will go to providers who will be helping specifically these cultural component communities. For that, I just want to say thank you for the time, and please support House File 4105. And I will also like to say thank you, Representative Thompson, for his support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Khalif. Any questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Thompson, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Just a point of clarification. You mention in your bill or describe in your bill community service centers, but then also later on in the bill, you're referencing FQHCs, but a community center is not a federally qualified care center. Community service centers aren't federally qualified care centers. So I'm just wondering if I'm misunderstanding or if there needs to be some clarification in the language itself.
Representative Thompson?
I just found my unmute button. Thank you, Representative Albright. And I would defer that question to Mark Anderson, Chair Schultz.
Mr. Anderson, can you help address Representative Albright's question? I believe he's not able to. Representative Albright.
Okay, can I respond that for him, because it doesn't look like his mic is not open. I don't think the bill, this particular bill that we asked for the support, doesn't have a community center.
Representative Albright? Are you looking at the bill House File 4105, Representative Albright?
I am, Madam Chair. I'll just continue.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Representative Thompson, fairly substantial request. And anytime we look at expenditures, particularly from the general fund, as a fiduciary, we also look to see, you know, what measures of accountability, the measurement of the goals that are laid out and what oversight would look like for a grant program like this. So I'm wondering if you could address those issues.
Representative Thompson?
I think Mark is available. I think he got his mic up and going now. Chair Schultz.
Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, can you hear me?
We can. Please proceed.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm trying to do this on my phone. I guess I'm new at it, doing it on the phone. First of all, on the question on the FQHCs, the FQHC was just an example of the type of program, but that the you know, community-based, so there's a lot of community-based programs that you know, are tied in directly to communities that are not at that level of FQHC. They're not you know, federally qualified health centers, and so you know, that might be the confusion. But the FQHC is a premier organization in our state, and they would be one, but there would be other others that would have opportunity. It wouldn't just be excluded, be restricted to them.
Mr. Anderson, I'm going to just read the language.
The question about the oversight on the grants, we want to go through the Department of Health because we wanted this to be institutionalized, be part of our state system of supporting behavioral health providers that have these ties to communities to grow this. And so we'd be working with the Department of Health on those issues that the representative had asked about.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I'm just going to read the language I think Representative Albert is referring to. It says the commissioner shall provide grants to behavioral health provider organizations based in federally qualified health centers and tribal health programs and those providers with 50% of clients from African American, Somali, and other African populations, et cetera. So I believe that was what Representative Albright, was that what you were referring to?
It was, Madam Chair.
Any other questions, Representative Albright?
Yes, thank you. One final one. Representative Thompson, in the language of the bill, talks about an eligibility for outstate or rural communities to compete for these grant dollars, and you cite a level of 20% of their patients being from the aforementioned communities. How would they be able to demonstrate they have cultural competent therapists on staff under your language?
Representative Thompson?
Again, I'll defer to Mark Anderson.
Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, Representative, thanks for the question. You know, there's a conversation that goes on within our healthcare community here in Minnesota about what does culturally competent mean? Does it mean I went to a class and learned a little bit about a culture that's not my own? Or does it mean I'm deeply rooted in that culture? I'm really part of that community. And so we need to have that conversation. I don't think there's agreement necessarily within the healthcare community about the answer to that question, but the perspective of this piece of legislation goes toward that deeply rooted part of that community, not just someone that you know, has a minimal understanding of a community of a different culture than their own. And so we need to work with our providers, and you know, you heard some of them on the call here in the previous bill, who you know, are very you know, have been for many years working on these issues, and so we need to work with Department of Health and to make sure that's what we're doing when we implement this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Representative Albright, for the questions. But I will just note that it's providers, behavioral health providers within FQHCs and other types of providers was the point why I read that language. Representative Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to say I like the idea of this bill very much. I think it's very much needed, and I really have appreciated hearing from the testifiers today. And forgive me if I missed this, but I just wanted to see, ask Representative Thompson or maybe his testifier, why it's going through the Department of Health rather than Human Services, and whether you've worked with the agency to see, you know, how able they are to do this, because it does seem like somewhat of a big undertaking to, I don't know how many different entities this would be, and I'm really interested in seeing that it, you know, if it can really be done, because as I said, I really like the idea very much. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Thompson, any response?
Real quick, Chair, I want to defer to Mark on this question, but real quick, the idea behind this bill, I have to be real blunt, but I thought about George Floyd, because George Floyd came here from Texas, and he came here for rehab, drug treatment. He came here because he was homeless, but also he had mental health issues also. And ultimately what happened was we fed him fentanyl, an overdose of a knee to the neck, and we didn't give him what he came to Minnesota for fully. Here's the other pieces. I lost my friend. I spoke to my friend outside of the store. We talked about the murder of Alton Sterling that day in 2016. And the very next day, I watched my friend murdered live on social media. Orlando Castillo was murdered, you know, the very next day after we talked about Alton Sterling. And then pushed further down, my friend Rajan, he hung himself in his garage after I had spoken to him over the phone. Then I turned around and my son was shot 6 times at a funeral, and then I lose my mother. It's all happened in 1 year. So people were telling, you probably need to see a behavioral health specialist. And I'm like, I'm not crazy. I don't need to see anybody. I'll fix it. I'll, you know, just this macho man. But in reality, I had already been seeing a behavioral health specialist, and I stopped. I started going to see the woman. And the first thing I said to her was, I was crazy for not coming to see you. And honestly, I had no idea that I had mental health, you know, issues. But what happened post, she called me one Thursday and she says, you can't come. I had an appointment. You can't come. And I said, well, what happened? Well, her facility was burned down post the George Floyd uprising. So trying to find somebody within my community who matched this woman is like virtually impossible in our community. And I wanted to share that, but then defer that question that you asked to Mark, because this is how serious it is for me and my family. And I'm trying to like make it, we probably won't see the benefits of the work that we do. We probably won't, but our grandkids will, I promise you, because we're actually benefiting from some civil rights leaders way before our time and some of the hard work that they put in. But I want to defer to Mark, Rep. Schultz. I just wanted to share that with you guys and defer that question to Mark.
I don't know if Mr. Anderson will be able to answer that question, but I see Chair Liebling's hand is up. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks, Representative Thompson. I'm not opposing what you just said. I've heard you say many of those things before, and I really appreciate all of that. I'm just thinking about, you know, if we can get this bill to the finish line, how do we actually do it? How do we, and I don't mean deliver the service. I mean get the money out the door to the places it needs to go. That's what I'm talking about. And I'm just wondering on the very practical nuts and bolts level, if you've had conversations with anybody who would actually be doing this, getting the money out the door, deciding, kind of going back to Representative Albright's question, you know, who gets it, how much to get, how do we find them? How do we make sure they know to apply? All those things that have to happen to get the money out the door to where it needs to be. That's really the thrust of my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And Representative Thompson, I know you're a new legislator, so I think what we're suggesting, and Chair Liebling may be suggesting, is please reach out to an MDH and agencies and work with them on your bill quickly.
That was my intent, is to work with MDH and also DHS, Chair Liebling. That was the intent of this language, because we can't do it alone. In order to transform systems, we definitely have to do it together. And so I would love to work with you also, Chair Liebling. And like she said, I have a friend. No, I'm considering myself a sophomore now, but I'm still a freshman. But I definitely want, if it makes sense for my community, like I have the keys to the car. And the community just gets in and says, John, drive. And drive us to the finish line. Honestly, I know what makes sense for the community, because a lot of community members come to me So working with DHS and these organizations within our public sectors here, like the DHS and Minnesota Department of Health, Anyway, working with these organizations would be the best thing for me to do because I can't do it alone. And so I open my arms and say, please help me.
We will help you, Representative. We will help you with those connections, Representative
yes,
Thompson.
Please help me.
With that, we have to close discussion on this bill, but thank you, testifiers, and thank you, Representative Thompson, for working on this. And it looks like you will have a little bit more work to do. With that, members, House File 4105 is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. The next item on our agenda is House File 3414. I'm going to move to adopt the division report from Behavioral Health. This is a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And I see, Representative Frederick, that you have an A3 amendment. Do you want to quickly describe it or would you like to adopt it first and then describe it?
I can just very briefly describe it.
Go ahead.
The amendment takes out two provisions, Madam Chair, and then incorporates DHS feedback.
Excellent. So members, with that, I'm going to move the A3 amendment to House File 3414. Please unmute yourself. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Frederick, and my motion is to lay House File 3414 as amended over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Frederick, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm going to kind of talk quickly here looking at the time. It's an SUD bill. It looks at substance use disorder treatment and what life is like after someone successfully completes treatment. Because as it sits right now, most people are just left to their own devices to try to be successful. And we know quite often that can be a challenge. And so this looks at housing supports, transportation supports, daycare, food assistance. It looks at strengthening the workforce to get more people to be able to be into this field. It tackles rate reimbursements because, I mean, we're looking at every sector that's, you know, people are not getting paid enough when you're trying to compete with the private sector. And a whole bunch of other things. We heard testimony in behavioral health regarding paperwork reductions and other aspects. So we've had several meetings with DHS. We've had, I can't even count how many meetings at this point to try to get feedback. I would actually like to specifically thank Ms. Sunderman and her assistance on this because I know that there have been several amendments and she has worked very hard. And so I just want to make sure I'm very public about saying thank you to her for this. Madam Chair, again, I'm just trying to be brief and I know I have testifiers that are looking to share and speak about it as well.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. And I will remind members that we are going until 12:30 today. But thank you for speaking fast anyway. Okay, the first testifier we have is Brian Zerbs. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Brian Zerbis, Vice President with North Star Behavioral Health, a substance use disorder organization in Minnesota. I'm also here representing MARCH as a co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee. I'll be providing an overview of a couple of articles that Representative Frederick had referenced. And just for the committee members, some additional background. These bill components are really based on interviews with hundreds of clients, people in treatment for substance use disorder, as well as scores of counselors and programs based on what their needs are, what some of the challenges are, specifically related to documentation requirements and trying to address burnout. And the third component is around service preservation access, how we can try to reduce barriers for programs, get usable data, have substance use disorder programs and organizations be able to operate it as efficiently as possible. In sections 2 and 3, there's a component regarding birth record, being able to obtain birth records. Through interviews with clients, we've become aware that as people move from house to house or go from one treatment to another, they often lose or have important documents stolen or lost, including birth certificates. So sections 2 and 3 would allow an individual that's on medical assistance to be able to obtain that birth certificate without a charge. In section 5, along a similar line, being able to obtain their driver's license, concept that these are important documents that these folks need to have to be able to get back on their feet. And section 8 is regarding a withdrawal management requirement, and it expands the type of supervised living facilities that withdrawal management programs can operate with. Currently, they can only operate with what's called a supervised living facility Class B license, which is for non-ambulatory individuals. There is also a classification called supervised living facility Class A, which is for ambulatory individuals. In sections 9 and 14, it touches on a topic called guest speakers. Currently in SUD programs, I myself am a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. I can facilitate groups and speak with clients on topics that are relevant to their recovery. However, I personally am not in recovery. And if I wanted to have one of my employees or a guest speaker come in, someone that's in long-term recovery, to speak about the challenges of addiction or reintegration to the community, et cetera, I could show a TED Talk or a video of that person. However, I could not bring that person physically into the group room to have that conversation and interaction with the person. So this bill language defines who a guest speaker is and also clarifies that I, as the qualified professional, would be providing direct observation and responsible for performing the documentation of that treatment service. Section 10 touches on record documentation requirements. And in this part, what is new, it identifies the time frame for documenting a significant event. Currently, statute says it needs to be documented immediately. What this language does is it clarifies that significant events need to be documented within 24 hours. On section 11 is on a treatment plan review. And on this part, what is being proposed is to extend the timeline for treatment plan reviews. Currently, substance use disorder programs have to do a treatment plan review every week or every 7 days. And what we're proposing is to extend that to up to every 28 days. Some of the right reasoning behind this in the mental health world, in statute 245I, the minimum requirement for treatment plan updates is every 180 days. So for SUD programs, going from 7 to 28 it would be beneficial. Also, based on interviews with clinicians, the treatment plan reviews on a week-over-week basis, about half the time counselors don't actually make an update to the treatment plan because there's not a lot of significant movement or changes in a week-over-week basis. But that 7-day requirement means that they still have to do it and go through that paperwork. The next section 12 is on transition and follow-up counseling. So this would allow the ability for intermittent counseling or intermittent services up to four hours of counseling per month without requiring the treatment provider to redo a comprehensive assessment, reopen a treatment plan, do treatment plan reviews and things like that. So it really helps focus in on people that are, you know, typically outside of intensive treatment but needing intermittent counseling or some tune-ups here or there. Section 13 touches on transition support. So this is the package that Representative Frederick referred to as the braided services, recognizing that once someone completes treatment and they go back into the world, the minefield of housing and transportation and obtaining employment, all of these challenges and barriers are present. So what this section does is it has a set of packages that this people that complete treatment would be eligible for for up to 6 months. And I think with that, that's it for my part, Madam Chair. With that, I'll pass it off to Tina.
Thank you, Mr. Zerbis, and I will do that. The next testifier is Tina Silverness. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing us to testify today. For the record, my name is Tina Silverness, and I am the CEO for the Center for Alcohol and Drug Treatment here in Duluth. I'm also a member of March's Board of Governors and a co-chair for the Government Affairs Committee. So I'll just briefly go over the sections that Brian Zervas didn't cover. And I'll start with HIV training and SUD treatment. This section just simply requests that the commissioner outline HIV subtopic sections so that providers can develop their own accurate training. Next, under the direct care staff increase, this proposal would allow a 10% base rate increase for direct care staff. Providers continue to lose staff to other industries who pay much higher wages and benefits. So essentially, we are asking that the legislature implement workforce solutions with rate increases for the care industries. If they do that, SUD providers would like to be included in this. The next section is under rate requirements, which simply proposes that the commissioner establish rates for SUD providers and for the service enhancements. These services would include outpatient treatment, comprehensive assessments, treatment coordination, peer recovery services, withdrawal management, MIT services, and residential treatment. This section also addresses the need for flexibility in the residential treatment hours and co-occurring staff requirements. This proposal would provide a means for programs to get reimbursed when a patient's unable to attend all their weekly treatment hours. Much like their needed medical and dental appointments, they have mandated court dates, and some of them get sick with COVID-19. This proposal also allows for providers to determine the adequate staffing complement for co-occurring programming, as long as they meet the basic requirements. The next section addresses the temporary rate increase. In the 2021 session, the Commissioner of Human Services was directed to conduct a substance use disorder rate methodology. Base rates have essentially held flat for the last 12 years. This proposal would provide a temporary rate increase of 14% beginning in July of 2024, but only if the new rate setting process has not been implemented. Once the rate methodology is implemented, this temporary increase would expire. The next section is under the commissioner to collect additional data. This section proposes that the commissioner collect additional data on programs that receive appropriations from the Behavioral Health Fund, and the data be posted to the department's website to help providers improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the program. The final section of the bill would simply expand the due dates for the paperwork reduction report, allowing adequate time for the current contracted vendor to complete the report. I want to thank the Madam Chair and members of the committee. This concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Silverness, for testifying today. The last testifier I have is Amy Delwell. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then continue with your testimony. Is she with us, Representative Frederick? Or are you?
Madam Chair, if I may. I believe it was just Tina and myself for this hearing.
Oh, sorry. Okay, my mistake. She's listed, but thank you, Mr. Zervas, for clarifying that. So we have a question. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing this bill. I actually like a lot of it, but I do have a couple of questions and concerns. First, on the section that deals with the transition support, I'm concerned about this because it seems like it's for anyone who's completed treatment of 15 hours per week. I could see a much stronger case if people had been in full-time residential treatment, but I'm not sure why this is necessary. If people are getting treatment 15 hours a week, they have the opportunity to have other employment. So could you explain why you chose that threshold?
Representative Frederick, would you like to answer or go to a testifier?
I will just answer briefly, and then I will let Mr. Zervis chime in as well. Part of the goal of this bill, too, is to kind of change how SUD is viewed. And we don't want it, because currently it's kind of viewed as like it's the common cold, that once you get over the cold, you're done, and you can just keep move on and live your life. Where this is an attempt to show that when it comes to substance use disorder, that it's a chronic disease, something that people will be living with and have to be able to manage it for the long term. And the counseling services in this bill, too, is wanting to people to have access to counseling long term while also putting supports in place for them, whether it is that transportation or childcare or whatnot. But I think I will let Mr. Zervis fill in some of those details.
Mr. Zervis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins, the reason for 15 in residential programs, they have required numbers of hours in a treatment week for high, medium, and low. So high intense residential programs have to provide 30 hours or more, in medium intensity or 15 hours or more. For outpatient programs, or intensive outpatient programs, there's not a set number currently of how many hours, but the 15 hours of residential and above seem to make sense. So we align those hours for intensive outpatient. And I would add that the successful completion, the timelines for residential programs, you know, maybe weeks from intake to completion to successfully complete the treatment regimen. Likewise, an outpatient, typically that may take months of going through 15 hours a week of intensive outpatient treatment.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for those answers. I guess my concern is that they're already receiving MA, assume maybe other programs, right? Is that not generally true?
Mr. Zervis?
They might be, but I think the intention of this is to have these funds available for individuals that don't have access to that. We did work with state agencies on making sure that like the transportation card, for example, ensuring that there's not duplication. So if someone is eligible for something elsewhere, that this source of funding wouldn't duplicate that.
Representative Robbins.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. I just hope that is clarified, because it seems like, from what I can tell, they're getting $500 a month for housing and $500 a month for food support and up to $120 a month for gas. So that's, you know, $1,120 a month for 6 months. So I like to be generous, but, you know, I also like to watch the taxpayers' money. So I just think the threshold and clarifying, not duplicating benefits would be some helpful clarification. Madam Chair.
Representative Frederick, would you like to respond?
Yes, just very briefly, Madam Chair. I can appreciate what Representative Robbins is getting to. We're not looking to duplicate services. The transportation piece, too, I mean, there was very much a deliberate attempt to try to say, you know, they get it if they need it, or they get, you know, the bus pass, and then they don't get the gas card and that kind of thing. But some to the overall dollar value, housing and cost of living is ridiculous. You know, like just a basic apartment or anything like that nowadays. I was flabbergasted with the other day when I just went online looking for a basic, simple, not fancy, kind of the cheapest housing that I could find. And then with the cost of everything else, I hope that it's not a barrier for people to support this, because from just a real world look with the cost of everything out there, I think this is a dollar value that I think will hopefully make an impact.
Okay, Representative Robbins, I'm not seeing your hand up. Did you have any final comments?
I have one more question on a different section. Is that okay?
It's fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frederick. So I did also want to just ask a question about the free birth record section. So looking at the bill, which I have up on this other computer, which is why it looks like I'm looking away from you, So it says that they have to complete the normal application and then get a statement that's verifying their identity and then a statement of eligibility that they qualify for MA. So to me, this is a lot of cumbersome stuff, way more than just the application. So I'm wondering, you know, why is this necessary and what sort of channeling my Judiciary Committee friends, like there's no audit trail. So we don't know who is accessing this data to prove these eligibilities. There's no way to go back and see who did it. Now you classify the data as private, which is great, but I'm a little nervous about an agency employee who is not tracked providing this information. And I'm not sure why we need to provide free birth records for people who have been in treatment. Maybe free birth records for people who have been homeless or have their documents stolen, like specify that, but just free birth records for everyone who's been in substance treatment seems a little broad.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to say that this is, again, as Mr. Zerbis had stated, that there's often periods of homelessness associated with people who go through SUD treatment, and so then they don't have birth records. We're not looking to just give every person that happens to go through treatment to get a free birth record, even if they already have one. That is not the intention with this. But it is the intention that we get them one should they need it, because then they can use the birth record to get a state-issued identification card, that a state-issued ID then can help aid with employment. And it all just kind of builds off of each other to again, look at that holistic experience of someone when they go through treatment, when they don't have those supports, because we want to be able to, you know, for them to be able to get that job and stand on their own 2 feet as much as whatever looks best for them. And so this, again, it's a stepping stone process along the way from the birth record to an ID to aid in getting that employment in the long run. So we want to, and with that, when there's often not the same financial access to be able to purchase some of these things, which is why we wanted to waive some of those fees. I will say the model on this, or the language on this, apologies, is modeled after the homeless youth initiatives that we worked on, that the legislature worked on last year. And so then we had a meeting with the Department of Health, recently, these days are blurring together, to clarify some of this language and to make sure that we had their support on it as well.
Thank you, Representative Frederick.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins, I have to cut you off. Sorry. Okay. But I have a feeling you'll be hooking up with Representative Frederick and working on the language. But I really welcome your questions and concerns, because we don't want to pass bad legislation or legislation that had not. This is not bad. I mean, legislation that has concerns or problems. It would be nice to have bipartisan support. Okay, let's see. Representative Frederick, closing comments, any? And please be brief, because now we are behind.
I'll just say that there's been, countless meetings and hours put into this, lots of feedback. I always welcome more. So if Representative Robbins wants to connect on this, more than happy to. And I know that it wouldn't even just me, that we'd bring as many people to that table to have more conversations as possible. So always looking to improve, and I appreciate any and all support. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. It's great to see our young legislators working hard on bills, and I know Representative Frederick's been working hard on this, so it's great to see that. Okay, with that, members, House File 3414, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Our last bill on the agenda is House File, I'm just going to get this right, 4021, and I'm going to move to adopt the division report from the Behavioral Health Division. This will be a voice vote. Members, please unmute. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And I'm going to move to lay over House File 4021 in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Bolden, please tell us about your bill. And I'm not seeing any amendments. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am grateful to be before you with House File 4021 to establish a Children's Crisis Stabilization Service. Families, providers, counties, and advocates are in agreement that a children's crisis stabilization is greatly needed, now more than ever. As we know, too many children in mental health crisis are boarding in emergency departments or are charged and access care through juvenile justice, and too often are not receiving the crisis stabilization care that can meet the child's immediate needs. The language in this bill was designed to support expedient implementation for the purpose of establishing and growing this most needed level of care. With that, I have a couple of testifiers here that will share more about the importance of this service and the design this bill proposes. So with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. We have Sue Abderholden. Welcome back to our committee. Great to see you again. You know the drill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I want you to imagine your child sobbing, so sad that they are telling you they don't want to live. Your 13-year-old is suicidal. As a parent, their pain travels into you. You bring them to the ER hoping they can help. But while your 13-year-old is clearly distressed, they actually don't have a plan to take their life, and the hospital beds are full, so they tell you to take them home. You bounce from wanting them to come home to wanting them to be admitted, but mostly you are scared because you don't know how to help your child. This is all too often a reality for many parents, including me. The pandemic has taken a toll on our children's mental health. We have seen an increase in depression and anxiety. We have seen overwhelming grief from children who lost a parent or caretaker to COVID. We've seen children struggle with being successful at school, not just academics, but socialization. But if a hospital won't or can't admit your child, what do you do? Some parents have actually refused to take their child home and now are being threatened with losing custody while their child is in the child protection system. One parent said the ER said to take him home and offered no other assistance, but her child's mental health problems caused her other children not to be safe. Another said, "We felt so lost in the shuffle. When we were in crisis, there was no place to go. There needs to be something besides child welfare, hospital, or jail." There is nothing you can do right now to magically fix this, but there are some steps that would help. In the adult system, we have crisis homes, places where adults can go who need hospital level of care, who don't need hospital level of care, but are in or heading towards a crisis. We don't have them for children, and we need them. In 2015, the legislature required DHS to conduct a study on how to develop and fund children's crisis residential services. 2 years later, that report was completed after research, interviews with families, youth, and providers. Recommendations included bypassing the path to residential placement to ensure timely access, provide short-term and longer-term stabilization. Families stated that they wanted more of a facility type versus a small group to ensure that more qualified staff were available to help their child. I know there are a lot of ideas floating around the Capitol about how to address the crisis in our children's mental health system. And again, there are no easy answers, but you have to look at what the real problem is. Children are being assessed. They are being seen by professionals who see the child heading towards a crisis. The problem is that we have nowhere to treat them. So children are boarding in the ER, not because we don't know what is wrong, but because we have nowhere to send them. There are waiting lists for school-linked mental health. There are waiting lists for hospital beds. There are waiting lists for residential treatment. There are waiting lists for CTSS and day treatment. We have narrow networks in our private health insurance plans. Private insurance won't even pay for psychiatric residential treatment facilities. We have providers struggling with recruiting and retaining staff. There is a lot to do. But what this bill does is quickly address one level of care that we don't have in the children's mental health system. We are building on what we already have so we can move fast. We really need to move fast on this. Residential treatment centers can set aside a few beds to be used for shorter periods of time, and shelter beds can help children as well. These services, with minor alterations, can begin to help address the crisis, can begin to help these children and their families. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. And the next testifier I have is Timothy Hunter. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Tim Hunter, Regional Program Coordinator for the CREST Adult Mental Health Initiative in Southeast Minnesota. And thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House File 4021. Thank you, Representative Bolden, for authoring this legislation. As Ms. Edward Holden had said, you know, we aim to kind of create a pathway for children experiencing mental health services and access much needed support and safety. So thanks to the 2018 work done, we were fortunate enough in Southeast Minnesota to receive bonding funds to construct a mental health center here in Rochester, Minnesota. So as a 10 county region of community providers, hospitals, with our, you know, health partner plans and advocates, you know, we set out to operationalize the facility. And so we have a provider with Nexus Family Healing that's able to operate a 24/7 service with trained mental health staff that provide crisis assessments, individual crisis stabilization in a warm, trauma-informed, person-centered environment. To make this happen, there were a number of certifications and things that we had to go through. On the adult side, very clear. We have RCS services under our current ERTS settings under Rule 36. We'll put that together and make it work and be more sustainable. On the children's side, this wasn't the case. We are currently licensed under Rule 2960 with a shelter license, which is not adequate to kind of pay for the service or make the service really accessible to those in need. And so as we kind of work to ensure access for youth, it's really, really important that we focus on creating a pathway of the right service delivery and outline the correct way. So we have been operating since about July of 21, really end of July, early August. And I can tell you the impact has been felt greatly. So we know locally that we are seeing a really high number of youth and families experiencing anxiety, depressive symptoms, suicide ideation, and our model offers a no wrong door policy. So there's no diagnostic eligibility. If somebody wants to walk in, they walk in. And what we're seeing on a daily basis is the number one referral source is self and families. People are walking in to look and seeking help every day for their unique situations. It's closely followed by our relationship with hospitals and emergency departments that are looking for step downs for families to be safe in the community. So as we're kind of looking at that, our average length of stay right now is about 7 to 10 days. And we're really seeing families with various issues and unique circumstances. And so we offer not only the ability to cope with that, but oftentimes the ability to kind of navigate and bridge to other parts of the system that aren't currently available in real time, in real crisis. About 60% of the individuals that we are serving right now are on a state Medicaid plan. And so really looking at a very vulnerable population, being able to serve them in real time. A story about how this works or how this looks. It's an individual recently was dropped off at the Southeast Regional Crisis Center. Individual was scared, alone, described as fragile. The mental health staff spent hours assessing to make sure that the individual was put in the right level of care. That happened to be our crisis residential unit in our facility. During that 10 days with us, the individual thrived. The individual worked on repairing family relationships, engaged with staff, engaged with other residents, really looking at finding hope for the future and also helping the other residents find hope as well. We moved to a safe discharge that was arranged for follow-up services and stabilization services back in the community. So again, I think, you know, by passing House File 4021, we can kind of begin the conversation in Minnesota and being able to offer these safe environments for children in crisis across the state. And again, we ask that we are providing funding to these programs that can support children at the time of crisis before it becomes an emergency. So I thank you all again. And again, I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Any questions from members? I'm not seeing any. People must be hungry and want to go to lunch. Representative Bolden, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I'm getting a lot of emails and support, so I really appreciate the work that's done. And thank you, testifiers. I see Representative Robbins popped up. Did you have a question, Representative Robbins? No? Okay. Any final closing comments, Representative Bolden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill. Thank you to the testifiers for being here today and for the work that they are doing, and just ask for support. This is an opportunity for us to get care for children in our communities who are in crisis. And right now, there's not a great mechanism for that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. Really appreciate your work on all of our bills this session as well and your expertise. So with that, members, House File 4021 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Okay, members, we have finished the agenda. I will see everybody bright and early at 8:30 tomorrow morning. And I'll just warn you that because it's deadline week, we may end up having to add one or two additional bills. So just please watch your email and be understanding if that happens. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Enjoy the rest of your day.